Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome all to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, November 3rd, 2020, we're having a special Courthouse Steps Oral Argument Teleforum on Jones v. Mississippi. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note, as always, that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our expert. And we're fortunate to have with us this afternoon Mark Levin. He's Chief of Policy and Innovation, Right on Crime, at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Mark's going to give us some opening remarks, and then we'll open it up to audience question and answers. So be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of our call. Thanks for being with us here today, Mark. The floor is yours.
Thanks so much. And I know this oral argument was what everyone was on pins and needles for today. But I'm going to start with just a summary. And then after that, I'll talk a little bit about the how originalism applies in this context or might apply, depending on your perspective. And then three trends in this area in terms of where states have been going. And included in that, I'll talk about some recent polling on the issue of juvenile life without parole and alternatives to it, in case you haven't had enough polling in recent days. And then finally, some of the policy issues involving recidivism, cost, and other factors that affect the way the public looks at this and the way policymakers look at it. So, you know, I'll just start by saying, of course, whether something's a good idea from a policy perspective is not the same question of whether the Constitution requires a particular policy outcome. So the oral argument today in Jones versus Mississippi really focused on a very narrow question, which is whether the court was required to make a finding, explicit or implicit, that the youth is permanently incorrigible. And in this instance, we were dealing with a 15-year-old person, Brett Jones, who killed his grandfather at the age of 15, and he was sentenced in 2005, and then he had a resentencing in 2015, and the court at that point decided to keep in place the life without parole sentence. And just to take you a little bit through the oral argument now, I'll kind of explain the back and forth that we saw. And obviously, it's quite interesting because I know many people wanted to see how the newest justice, Amy Coney Barrett, what her comments would be in this regard, and I'll certainly get to that. But at the outset, the attorneys for the defendant basically said, look, the court at the rehearing, you know, basically did not comply with the letter of the law in Montgomery, which basically extended the Miller decision, because the court did not say that it was using as a dispositive factor whether Brett Jones was permanently incorrigible, which is essentially to say whether he was incapable of rehabilitation at any time in his future life. Chief Justice Roberts asked, you know, what type of finding the defense would like to see. That exchange kind of revealed that the defense was not running a formal finding, because actually in Montgomery, it said that it implied that wasn't necessary, but some state by the judge, for these reasons, I've determined that in this case, Brett Jones is permanently incorrigible. And one of the things to point out is that the Justice Alito got in pretty early into the give and take, and he kind of expressed concerns that go back to his dissent, both in Miller and Montgomery, and really back to what the Eighth Amendment issue is in this case, which is whether this the practice of juvenile life without parole, at least without these explicit considerations, is cruel and unusual punishment. And at one point, Justice Alito said, you want to take us and the courts into very deep psychological waters. He quoted Gandhi in terms of saying Gandhi said no one is beyond redemption, and referenced the good thief on the cross. And so Justice Alito basically asked, how can a judge determine for sure someone over, which could be 50 50 or 60 years in the future could never change, and there's not a really high bar. And the counsel for the defendant essentially said the court would obviously not have a crystal ball, but the court could just cite the reasons based on the defense counsel said, looking at the nature of the crime, looking at did that youth have a long criminal record, did they show remorse, things like that. And I thought at that point the defense might have missed an opportunity to point out that, you know, this particular finding, just like aggravating and mitigating factors, it's well established in the law, would be not based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt, based on preponderance of the evidence. So yes, of course, you can't say for 100% sure someone won't. There's no way they'll be rehabilitated. You can't know what's going to be in their head decades from now, but perhaps defense counsel could have allayed Justice Alito's concerns a little more by saying, look, it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. So then we went on with Justice Alito trying to kind of, I would say, downplay the whole Miller and Montgomery by saying that we just need to look at what they ultimately held, which was requiring some type of, you know, reasoning before sentencing a juvenile to life without parole, and that we shouldn't kind of delve too deeply into the language of Montgomery, where it does talk about permanent incorrigibility finding. At this point, Justice Sotomayor got in, and it was kind of surprising because she had some tough questions for the defense lawyer, even though, of course, most people would think she will end up on the side of the defense, but basically saying, I think maybe harkening back to her time as a trial court judge, saying, you know, does the trial court judge have to use the magic words? And he did say he was considering the Miller factors, such as, you know, the youth-related circumstances, even though the judge did not reference permanent incorrigibility. And so there was an interesting exchange there. We also then heard from Justice Gorsuch, who brought up the issue of if we are going to say Montgomery added this new requirement that the permanent incorrigibility issue be dispositive, that would that be a substantive change versus a procedural change under Teague, which would determine whether it was retroactive or not. So there was a fair amount of discussion about that. And I think there was Justice Kavanaugh who got in, brought up the issue of what kind of record does the judge have to establish if we're going to say the judge should have said, made an explicit determination that Brett Jones was permanently incorrigible. And he emphasized the fact that the court was clear in Montgomery, they weren't requiring a formal fact finding. Chief Justice Roberts said, wouldn't just a sentence or two do? And the defense basically agreed with that. And Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who I referenced earlier, she really didn't give too many hints in her questions. They were pretty technical in nature. She asked whether also hypothetically, even if the proper process was followed, the defendant could still raise a challenge to the proportionality of the sentence. And it was a little surprising that the assistant solicitor general said that there could be. But ultimately, I don't think that's kind of going to play into the outcome of this. So at the end of the day, as far as where the justices line up, I think it's clear based on their prior dissents, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas will almost certainly, again, determine that cruel and unusual punishment should be looked at in the context of what was considered to be that, so at the time of the founding, and that we should really go back from this decades of jurisprudence that has emphasized the evolving standards of decency. I think Chief Justice Roberts, because he really dominated the beginning with the questions about, you know, what would be enough in terms of the judge's specificity of their findings, I think he's going to take a very narrow approach to the case. And I think that there were some hints that Kavanaugh would be with Roberts in that regard. And of course, Kavanaugh, his closeness with former Justice Kennedy, who obviously this jurisprudence really stems from him more than any other judge. So I think that might also be suggestive of that, although certainly Justice Kavanaugh is going to make his up his own mind without regard to Justice Kennedy. So, and I think Justice Barrett, there weren't really any strong hints about whether she would fall more into Scalia. And I'm sorry, well, of course, Scalia would be definitely where Thomas and Alito are, but whether she will fall with Thomas and Alito or more of a narrow approach, the Chief Justice Roberts might join the more liberal members of the court. So let me move to the second issue, which is just to comment a bit on this question of originalism. And I think one thing that's a really kind of interesting question for originalists to ask is whether some constitutional provisions kind of should be approached differently than others. And, you know, obviously, when you say something, when you say cruel and unusual, especially the word unusual, it would seem to suggest that perhaps the founders, the framers, the ratifiers, that they envisioned that it would, to some degree, change over time in a way. Slaughtering soldiers in your home isn't something that's going to be a different question 100 years later, right? And I mean, even things like there should be no law barring freedom of speech or the Second Amendment, perhaps have the same implicit reference to variability over time, an unusual punishment would. And of course, if they wanted to, they could have spelled out what practices were cruel and unusual. So, but on the other hand, there is a genuine, a serious concern that having such a nebulous standard of evolving standards of decency basically can lead to the totally unlimited substitution of basically where federal courts and judges substitute their opinion for that of the democratically elected branches. So it is important to kind of cabin this, not so much, I think, because members of the court were that concerned about how this particular case or even this whole issue of juvenile life without parole is resolved, but that obviously a sweeping approach with no way to cabin it could lead to lots of other practices or types of sentences being to be cruel and unusual and a flood of litigation and a role for the federal courts that overwhelms that of the democratically elected branches, or, you know, because in some states, of course, judges are elected, or at the minimum of a state, a federalism issue of basically where there's a greater involvement of the federal government through the federal courts than really was envisioned under our constitutional scheme. So it's a difficult question for that reason. So let me shift now to looking at the trends, including public opinion, as well as some of the policy factors. And obviously, these aren't necessarily ones that the courts should take into account, but they're ones that I think many of us find to be very compelling. So as far as we're concerned, after the Miller decision, a number of states, of course, basically because of these determinations are so laborious that the courts would have to make, decided to just get rid of juvenile life without parole. Texas actually did that back in 2009, even before Miller. But some of them, like Texas, set a very a long period, 40 years, before the child would be eligible for parole. But others have basically moved into a direction of 15 or 20 years, for example. And earlier in September of this year, the Ohio Senate, by a 29-4 margin, passed Senate Bill 256 that would set it at 18 years for youths convicted of case of crimes other than homicide and 25 years for homicide. So that now goes over to the Ohio House. In looking at public opinion, there's a survey from Data for Progress earlier this year, and they asked two questions. One dealt with, do you agree or disagree that no one should be sentenced to life in prison without the opportunity for parole for a crime they committed as a child? And overall, there were 57% in favor and 29% against, with 14% not sure. There was a bit of a partisan split, but it really was actually about even overall between Democrats and Republicans on that question, with even more Republicans than not agreeing that there should not be life without parole for juvenile crimes committed as a child. And then they also asked a separate question, which looked at whether there should be an opportunity for release before a judge or parole board after no more than 15 years, is the way they posed it. And that also got favorable responses, including from 64% of Republicans, with only 24% of Republicans opposed. And the numbers were similar among independents, slightly stronger among Democrats. You know, I think as with a lot of policy issues, there's a real question of why it would just seem to make sense given that there has been, I would argue, a change in how society views this in recent years, to just, why not just have democratically elected branches of government move forward regardless of what courts conclude. And some of the policy reasons that I think have led to this evolution of public opinion is, of course, first of all, there's been a lot of brain science showing how those who are youngsters, basically their capacity for impulse control, for judgment, and so forth, is not fully evolved. And now, of course, with the sophistication of brain scans, we can see how those parts of the brain not only change over time, but actually they can be examined while certain responses to stimuli are occurring. So there's some very compelling brain research. Now, none of that says that there should not be accountability, particularly for serious crimes, but it does tend to mitigate the culpability. And then, of course, the research on neuroplasticity essentially shows that the younger brain is more impressionable, and so it's more susceptible to change. So if you can deliver the right program, when somebody is incarcerated for something they did at 15, 16, 17, you know, you have a better chance of changing their outlook going forward. So there's also been some studies regarding the outcomes for in terms of recidivism, for example, for juveniles sent to prison for sent to adult prison for homicide and other serious crimes. And in particular, there was a study that came out last year in Pennsylvania that found a 1% recidivism rate for these were juvenile lifers who served about 30 years on average before being released. And there were no homicides and virtually no crimes at all, but total of 1% recidivism rate. Then Michigan began resentencing many youths pursuant to Miller and Montgomery. And there were 70 who were tracked from 2016 to 2019, and none had recidivated. And I actually testified in Texas at a hearing last session on legislation that would have created a second look after 20 years versus the 40 years I referenced earlier. And one thing I noticed in just looking around the room at, you know, who was testifying, of course, there were a number of parents of those who were incarcerated, and, you know, they appeared to be maybe 60, 70 years old. And it really occurred to me that, of course, if you stick with the 40 years that Texas has now, when these youths are released, they're going to be, you know, 58, 59, 60, depending on perhaps how long the case took to process. Reality, most of their parents probably, and even siblings, may not be alive at that point in time, or certainly not in a position to assist with reentry. And of course, somebody sentenced to prison 40 years ago wouldn't know a cell phone or email if it hit him in the face. So there's also that. But I mean, how do you begin to, you know, get somebody into employment and self-sufficiency who's been in prison for 40 years and is now in their late 50s? And that puts aside, of course, the average lifespan for prisoners is 61 or 62. So both because of health issues before they were incarcerated and health issues while incarcerated and the challenges in medical care, there are many reasons why the lifespan is shorter. So I think there's a real reason to believe that reentry to where somebody can be self-sufficient is much more likely to occur if you don't wait till somebody's in their late 50s, for example, early 60s before they're released. So the other thing, of course, is cost. It's about $2.5 million at least to effectuate a juvenile life without parole sentence. And, you know, every year somebody's in prison. In some states, it's $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, depending on the state. So there's obviously a cost to the taxpayers. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about race in the criminal justice system during this year. And it is true that 56% of those sentenced to juvenile life without parole are African-American. It's also true there's a greater there's also a disparity among races in terms of the share of homicides and other serious crimes committed by someone of that age. But you do find disparities in some jurisdictions even after adjusting for that, but also can relate in some cases to the victim. There's some research showing that if the victim is white, there's more likely to be a life without parole sentence. So there's a lot of different considerations that policymakers have been looking at as they approach this. From our standpoint, public safety is the number one consideration. And so in the case of Texas and many other states where there's a parole board, in the event that there is a second look opportunity, the parole board will use an objective risk assessment that has been validated, meaning it's been tested retroactively to show that it's certainly not perfect, but helps inform their decisions about what risk somebody would pose. And of course, they also look at the record of the individual while they've been incarcerated. In this case, by the way, Brett Jones had an exemplary record, and there was testimony from his correctional officers about the GED he earned and that his behavior was exemplary and so forth. So, and then the parole board also importantly considers input from victims, survivors, prosecutors, family members. Really, everybody should have an opportunity to have their voice heard. So, these second look laws aren't guarantees, but they are an opportunity to be considered. I think obviously we'll have to wait for a few months to find out how the court rules in this and how the justices align. But I think it was rather, while it was a somewhat technical discussion on this kind of how explicit a judge has to be in their how they stated they interpreted Miller and Montgomery in particular. And of course, in this case, the Mississippi Supreme Court, the guidance they provided to judges did not reference permanent incorrigibility. So that was one of the issues that was discussed. But I think regardless of how the court rules, in light of the research and public opinion, I think we'll continue to see states move away, not only from juvenile life without parole, but also move away from what is often the equivalent in terms of a 40-year time frame before someone can be reviewed by a judge or parole board to something probably around half of that for an initial review. So with that, I look forward to questions and comments as well. I think we have some folks on the line who probably know as much or more about this than I do, and some may have even personal experience. So look forward to opening it up. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And we've got a caller lined up now.
Hi, this is Kent Schreiter, Mark. I'm curious if you attach any significance to Justice Kagan's assessment that Montgomery was an aggressive interpretation of Miller. I think dishonest would be more candid. Do you think there's any chance that the court will backtrack on Montgomery and return to what it said in Miller, that it was establishing a procedural rule along the lines of Woodson and Lockett for capital cases and not a categorical exemption for a particular class of persons?
No, that's a good question. I'm sorry I didn't mention Justice Kagan's remarks. I'm glad you brought it up. I guess that's a good question. I think it's not that often, as all of us know, that the court expressly reverses a prior case. So I guess I would be reluctant to say there's likely to be five justices to expressly overturn Montgomery. But you're right, that was a big focus of the oral argument as to how much did Montgomery add to Miller. It can be read perhaps as privileging this issue of permanent incorrigibility over other factors, or essentially making that, the defendant's argument was obviously that that's kind of a precondition. In other words, if you find that the defendant is not permanently incorrigible, then you have to not impose juvenile life without parole. If you basically find that they're permanently incorrigible, then you can do so, although you wouldn't necessarily be required to do so. So I guess it really is unclear, but I think it was somewhat surprising that perhaps that Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan did have some tough questions for the defense side as well. And I think it's kind of, in some ways, it's gratifying that, and there were some conservative justices who asked tough questions of the lawyers for the government.
And I think that's it's gratifying to see those. And I don't think unexpected, but perhaps outside of the judicial proceedings these days, where, you know, you tend to see leading questions from, you know, members of Congress and such on each side. I think it was edifying.
So, Mark, we don't have any questions in the queue, but I guess I'll just we do have one now.
Hi, this is Christopher Melling from BYU Law. Can you expound a little bit on so the evolving national standards with Eighth Amendments, cruel and unusual. I know you spoke specifically about, Echoes of Scalia, Thomas, and whatnot. Do you think that that's going to become more of a fight? You know, for example, Justice Barrett would be in that camp of moving away from the evolving national standard of what defines cruel and unusual. Or do you think that the momentum is to stay with that trend that we've seen over the last, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, and I Kent may have some thoughts on that too. But I think it was unclear. I mean, Justice Alito was very clear that he hasn't changed his mind since his dissent, and I don't think there's any reason to think Justice Thomas has either. So I think it was unclear if Justice Barrett, her questions were so kind of focused on this really ancillary issue of whether I think it's hard to say. I think there's a chance she would join Alito and Thomas, which would be three votes to fundamentally, rethink the jurisprudence. It didn't seem to me like Kavanaugh. I wasn't entirely clear, but I think he seemed to be closer to Roberts in terms of focusing on kind of distinguishing Montgomery and kind of a very narrow approach to ruling on this that frankly could get, the votes of it didn't seem like there was much difference really between Sotomayor and Roberts, for example. So, if Kavanaugh and Barrett both were to join Alito and Thomas, then that would obviously be four votes right there. But I would tend to think that Gorsuch. Now we didn't mention Gorsuch. It wasn't really clear where he was. He kind of posed a hypothetical saying, if Montgomery added a new requirement, shouldn't we determine if it should be retroactive? So he was kind of, when you pose hypothetical questions like that, it's not really easy to discern where Justice Gorsuch was coming from. But theoretically, right, if you had Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Alito and Thomas, that would be five votes. My impression was probably of all those, Kavanaugh is the least likely to end up there. It just wasn't possible to read the tea leaves enough on Gorsuch and Barrett.
Go to our next question now.
Yeah, hi. This is Mitchell Keeter. I just want to question a little bit that public opinion poll that you described, at least three reasons. Number one, I think when many respondents hear the term child, they might think of someone who's 12 or 13 and not 16 or 17. It also did not seem to describe even the type of offense, let alone the specific facts of the offense that might lead people in the other direction. And then finally, it's one thing to ask if someone should be punished. It's another to ask, should a jury be able, based on the specific facts of the case, to conclude that someone needs to be confined in prison? I just think that's a little different way of wording it that could easily produce a significant change in the results. Because as we know, the wording can often determine, the wording of a question can often determine the outcome. Because, regardless of culpability, I mean, that's a question regarding retribution. But even Atkins has never gone further to preclude life without parole because there's still the concern about incapacitation. And it just will basically become a question of, false positives versus false negatives. There's a possibility the person will reoffend. There's a possibility he won't. And how do we balance those risks? And it's not really a question of culpability at all, but of public safety. And it just seems to me that the terms that they used about about rehabilitation and incorrigibility almost holds out the demand that there be a 0% chance that this person could ever be rehabilitated. And I mean, there's no one has a 100% chance of reoffending, and nobody has a 0% chance of reoffending. And the question is, what do we do with those cases in the middle? So I just want to question, I think the way those polling questions are worded can really produce significant swings in the outcome.
Yeah, no, I think you make a good point on that. Certainly, everybody has a different perception of who's a child, and obviously a 3 or 5 year old is a child too. So, you know, you're right. The question do not provide a specific age range, and so I think overall polling that I've seen in this area is fairly. It's not unanimous by any means, but I think the majority of Americans, you know, are tend to be supportive of alternatives to juvenile life without parole. The other issue you raised in terms of, I would argue, kind of from a Hayekian perspective, you know, we all have imperfect information. That's part of the reason, you know, that you want the, you know, in a free market economy and not central planning by the government, right? Well, you know, you have more information 15, 20 years later, if you're a judge or parole board looking at the individual than whoever was making the decision at a 15, 16 year old at the time of sentencing in terms of what they've done while they're incarcerated. And obviously it provides more of an incentive for somebody who's incarcerated to behave well and to complete programs if they know there's at least a chance they might, you know, get out of prison eventually versus, and there has been statements by prison officials saying that someone who's has life without parole, and obviously this applies to adults too, that because there's no possibility of release, it's there can be more issues in terms of behavior management and so forth. So, I mean, I think that's secondary, obviously, to the broader questions, and people can come down on different sides in terms of how they approach this from a moral perspective. Obviously, my own view is that that we should provide an opportunity for someone to demonstrate they've changed over time. But certainly, if somebody has a perspective of, you know, judges and juries should be I can understand the view that whether it's from, you know, putting aside the public safety assessment, which I think is better done later, someone could say, I just think from a retributive standpoint, judges and juries should be able to like sentences even to juveniles. So there certainly are members of the public who have that perspective. I think it's a minority view. But overall, I do believe that regardless of kind of how the narrow issue in this case comes about, the best kind of, I think every side would agree, the way to affect the greatest number of cases and to have all sides and of the issue in terms of public opinion be considered is for state legislatures to take this up. Now, there is still juvenile life without parole at the federal level, but it's a very there was a proposal by Senator Booker, I believe, to get rid of that, which, you know, might be part of some future criminal justice reform bill, but it's a very small number of cases. So the vast majority of cases are state level. There's particularly there were many that, of course, have been resentenced in certain states like Michigan and Pennsylvania. So, but again, the broader issue is also, you know, okay, if we're not going to have juvenile life without parole, and you know, how long should somebody serve in these cases before their first parole review or judicial review, whether it's 15, 20, 25 years? And certainly, there's no kind of divinely ordained figure. It's really something for elected officials, for state lawmakers to kind of come to terms with and to take into account the views of their constituents.
Great. So, Mark, we don't have any questions in the queue right now. We've covered a lot of ground here. So why don't I offer you a chance for anything you haven't covered you want to bring up, or any closing remarks? Unless we get another question, I think we'll wrap it up a bit early.
Sure. Well, I know everybody's got a lot on their mind today, so I'm just grateful that, you know, this is something that people are concerned with. I think that I don't think the ruling in this case, one way or the other, will be as much of a catalyst as, of course, the Miller opinion was to begin with, because, of course, that did force states to reexamine their policies. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, it's really important to, as we, you know, communicate with the public in this area, that people remember there are, you know, there are distinctions between how what's constitutionally required, and that varies depending on your approach to interpreting the Constitution versus what's sound policy from a recidivism or other perspective. So obviously, I would hope, you know, members of the public, even those judges, that justices that end up ruling perhaps against Brett Jones, that doesn't necessarily mean that they think juvenile life without parole, or if they were a lawmaker. So, but nonetheless, I think it was a very interesting oral argument, and I think we appreciate everybody's comments today. So I hope everyone has a great day, and that we have a very interesting evening. So thanks a lot.
Great. And thanks, Mark, for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. And thanks to the audience for calling in and your great questions. As a reminder, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. And as usual, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming telephone calls. We're not done with this week of oral arguments, and we'll have some more telephone calls covering that this week. Also, be sure to check out our website for info about the National Lawyers Convention upcoming next week. So take a look at those panels and see which ones you want to register for. Thank you all for joining us today. We're adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.